Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Floating Worlds by Cecilia Holland, narrated by Kristen James. The Earth, January 1852 to January 1853.
These people were giants, Tony said. He waved up at the towering ruin before them. They built on such a scale, their ideas were so absolute and universal.
Paula said, they were fascists.
You can't have everything.
She scuffed her feet over the pavement, 2,000 years old, seamed with moss. She had never been good at history. Down the wide, straight street, a man in a white hat leaned back to take a snapshot of the ruins. Paula went down the steps and turned to look up at the building. On the frieze above the doors, stone masks hung, labeled. She tried to make out the lettering.
B-R-A? Haven't you ever been here before? Tony said.
He came up behind her, his hands in his pants pockets.
Once, when I was little, my mother brought me. We had ice creams afterward.
Why was everything so large? She shaded her eyes to see the letters.
M-A-N-T-E.
She would have to look it up.
What was it used for? A museum? A library? Something like that.
She looked around them. Both sides of the street were lined with ruins. Opposite, a wall still stood upright, the windows worn soft and round with age.
I don't like it, she said. It's arrogant. You're very provincial.
She grunted at him. They went along the street. Her footsteps rang noisily after her off the ruined walls. The pavement was hard and her legs hurt. Other people strolled around, their heads tilted back. On the street corner, a woman sat painting at an easel. Tony went straight toward her. Paula ambled after him. Opposite the museum, green vines swallowed the last remaining wall of another building. The yellow tongues of Sweet Mary reached out to the light. She veered across the pavement and picked one flower and sucked it for the trace of honey. She would have an ice cream on the way home. Voices here traveled far. Perhaps the stone carried them. She could hear people talking in the next street. She went up beside Tony. He stood next to the painter, his face pursed. Amused, she watched him put his head this way and that to see the picture from different angles. He was really a critic, not a writer at all. He knew every pose.
The lighting presents an interesting problem, he said.
The woman wiggled her brush in a muddy cup of water.
The dome light changes from day to day, almost from hour to hour.
Paula looked straight up overhead. The light was diffuse. It fell in pale sheets through the height of the dome, here blue and there definitely more yellow. It was hard to realize that the ocean covered them. Tony was discussing art with the painter. He sounded knowledgeable, but Paula did not understand anything he said. She went across the street. From here, she could see through the broken walls to the next row of ruins, and through them to the next, all huge, the biggest building she had ever seen. The people who had built this city had dominated the earth for three centuries, by money, by force, and by guile. They had colonized Mars, reached as far as Uranus, cracked atoms and made whole cities out of polymer, and Manhattan had been the heart of that empire.
You know a lot about art, the woman said to Tony. Do you paint?
He smiled at her.
I'm a writer. My name's Tony Andrea.
Oh, really? They shook hands. She had read his first book. Paula circled behind them to look at the watercolor. She did not like it. Cramped onto the square paper, the buildings looked small, like broken boxes. She put her hands in her jacket pockets, raising her eyes back to the ruins.
Are you a writer too? The painter said.
Paula shook her head.
We haven't figured out yet what Paula is, Tony said.
They walked off down the street.
A thick, tarry slab of the concrete had buckled up the pavement in the middle. The street ran off straight to the shining wall of the dome in the distance, bordered on either side by raised strips of poured stone. Paula stepped up onto the border. "Why is this part higher than the other?" Tony walked along the lower level beside her. She could see the balding crown of his head. Maybe when he was asleep, she would draw an ivy wreath on it. He said, "They drove their cars on this part, and the people on foot walked up where you are. Out of the way, see?" They drove their cars on the ground? No wonder the street was so broad. Were they horse-drawn? They were a little more advanced than that, Kitch. Ahead of them, the angle of the light changed. They were coming to the wall of the dome. A jagged shell of a building rose up from the street, hundreds of feet high, catching the light. She put her hand up between her eyes and the dome. It's glass. The dome light shone green as leaves along the edges of the walls. "That's a dumb thing to make a building out of." Tony laughed. He swung her off the border and down to the street beside him. "You really are a narrow-minded little materialist." "Did they live here? In glass buildings?" Some fable moved elusively at the edge of her memory. "No, they lived somewhere else and came in here during the day." "Now tell me the truth." "I'm sorry, Kitch, that is the truth." She stood looking up at the glass. Maybe in those days, glass had been more common than it was now. Waves of stain crossed it, traces of dry dust like tracks from the time when the ruins had been underwater. "Atlantis." "That's a different place entirely," Tony said. "That's an Aegea." They went on to the port. The covered boat waited in the brackish water of the dock, empty. Paula went down between the benches to the back, next to the steering box. Tony sat down beside her. "The doctor says he won't do the operation unless you sign a paper saying you know I can get you pregnant."
"What?"
"I know it's ridiculous, but he's an old bastard. He says he's tired of naturalizing the men and then 6 months later sucking out the women."
Paula leaned on the wall of the steering box, looking in at the controls.
"It's not up to him."
The long handle coming from the floor was probably the brake. She was surprised that having a baby would be so complicated. The boat rocked. People crowded on board.
"Are you having dinner with me tonight?" she asked.
"I have to work," Tony said. "I've been with you all day."
He was writing a metaphysical novel, of which she had already read three drafts. He was endlessly inventive without being especially creative, which made his books easy to read. He told her how he was changing chapter 3, where the hero murdered his wife. She wondered if he had made up the doctor's demand. Maybe he did not want a baby after all. The painter was maneuvering her easel through the door into the boat. Behind her, the boatman came in and pulled up the ramp. He got into the steering box beside Paula.
"Hang on, we may bump going through the locks."
The deck shuddered under Paula's feet. She heard the rumble of an engine. She turned to the window. The rubberized walls of the lock closed around the boat and slipped with a wet, slick plop past the window. The interior lights came on, making everything white. The boat rose straight up. Outside the window, the ocean was lit dark green from the dome wall they were passing. So close to New York, the sea was filthy. Flakes of garbage floated around the window. There was supposed to be an ancient dump here someplace, still leaking after hundreds of years. Tony was talking to the boatman about nautical design. The water outside the boat filled slowly with sunshine. She pressed her cheek against the clammy plastic of the window. Half a mile below, the Manhattan Dome glowed like a moon in the ocean. The boat surfaced. They flew across the choppy open water. Paula sat back. The other passengers talked in low voices. Tony sat absently licking the hairs of his mustache into his mouth and biting them off. Ahead, the southern end of the New York Dome reflected the late sunlight back across the water in a coppery trail.
In the western sky, rank with pollution, swirling with smoke, three images of the sun sank toward the horizon. Half the sky was brilliant ruddy orange. The boat yawed in the wind off the seacoast. They sank into the water again. The boatman steered them through the underwater lock and up to the surface of the terminal pond. Tony helped her down the ramp, steering her by one hand on her arm. They went into the terminal building and took the crowded vertical car to the roof bus stop. Dark was falling. The winking white light of an Airbus was coming above the trees. Tony stood beside her, rocking back and forth on his heels.
Write something down I can show my doctor, so he can take the plug out.
I think you ought to go to a doctor who minds his own.
The bus settled down onto the roof. She went up the steps beside the driver. She hadn't paid for a bus ride in days. She put a dollar into the box. Tony came after her, crowding her in. The bus was full, all the side benches taken. She went down the aisle to the back.
Do you like the name Jenny?
Tony asked.
I like Jennifer better.
Jennifer Mendoza sounds terrible.
She looked up at him, drawn by his earnestness. His eyes were blue, unexpected against his chocolate dark skin. Their baby would not have blue eyes.
Andrea is a girl's name.
It was a fad to name babies for their fathers.
I've been thinking about that, he said.
The bus slowed and settled down on a rooftop, and the lights blinked on and off.
Hobold Building, the driver called. Change for Crosstown. Next stop, the university.
What if it's a boy? Paula said.
Tony shrugged.
I have no preference in boys' names.
The bus flew off in a giddy curve. She clutched the railing to keep from falling. Out the window, beyond the fat woman on the bench, the blue night dome light shone on the surface of the lake. The bus crossed a hilly stretch of trees and lowered again. She slid between Tony and a row of knees toward the back door. She got off the bus near the turret of the biochemistry building. There was an arrow-shaped sign pasted to it, Celestial Mechanics Conference. She went across the campus. Most of the university was underground. On the silo of the technology building was another arrow-shaped sign. She liked the phrase Celestial Mechanics.
Maybe she would name the baby that.
She went through the park. It was dark under the trees, and she stayed in the open. An owl hooted. She stopped and waited, but heard nothing more. The top three stories of her building were above ground. She went in the front door, past the crowds of bicycles, and up to the third floor. In the circular middle room of the commune, a small knot of people already waited at the big table for the dinner rice. She stopped at the videone for her messages. There were no messages. She went to her room, in the back hall, threw her bag on the unmade bed, and went next door and knocked.
Who's there?
She opened the door and went into a tiny, crowded room. An Chu was standing at her drawing table sketching. Paula took off her jacket, dropped it on the bed, and stretched herself out on top of it and the other woman stacked clean sheets and towels.
We went to Manhattan. Have you ever been there? The Undersea Dome?
An Chu's beaked Aztec nose was an inch from the paper.
I can't stand being underwater. The job list is there on the bed.
Like Paula, An Chu was out of work. Paula sat up. She piled the clean laundry up into a single stack against the wall and found a long sheet of paper advertising jobs. Outside in the hall, someone called,
"The rice is out!"
An Chu took the bowl and went to get their dinner. Paula towed off her shoes. She got up to see the long sleeveless dress An Chu had been drawing. The walls of the little room were papered with sketches of clothes. An Chu brought the nutty fragrance of rice into the room.
"Here's one," Paula said, sitting down on the bed again.
"Swamper for an all-night bar. Prefer non-drinker."
An Chu located her cutting board and knife and began to chop vegetables.
"You drink."
A piece of celery sailed into Paula's lap, and she ate it.
"I could quit. What's a Bramante?"
"I think it's a place in Lisbon." I think it's a man. I'm glad I can't type.
Rows and rows of uninteresting jobs required typing. She watched Anchu pile up the green and orange vegetables at the side of the chopping block. Anchu's skin was golden, her lips full, her long eyes like jet. She swept the vegetables into the pot where they sizzled.
I have to get up early tomorrow, Paula said. Make sure I wake up, will you?
Why?
For the oral exam, for the committee.
Oh, Lord, you're still doing that?
It's a job. They pay better than anything else except the Martians.
If you ask me, Anchu said, stirring the vegetables, there's no difference between the committee and the Martians. They're all a powertrain.
Paula folded the job sheet and stuck it into a crack in the wall. She sat down on the floor, ready to eat.
Anchu was right about the committee. A worldwide company, it negotiated contracts and ran diplomatic errands for the rest of the middle planets. She had applied out of curiosity, and the tests had become a kind of joke. They asked for some training in interplanetary law, which she did not have, and gave aptitude tests in mathematics and science, which she knew she had flunked. It was amusing to answer tongue-in-cheek to all their solemn, stupid questions.
The other woman spooned up rice and vegetables into a bowl, and Paula reached for it, hungry.
The Committee for the Revolution had its New York office in a gully between the campus and the lake. The building was one story, with three or four air cars parked on the roof. When Paula got there, the waiting room was already full of people. She crossed through the crowd, conscious of the stares, and read down the schedule on the bulletin board. Her name was third on the list for the oral exam. She could not leave to get her breakfast as she had planned. There was no place to sit. She stood by the wall next to the desk. She had seen most of the other people at the written examinations. Nearly all were younger than she was by 5 or 6 years. They bent over their notebooks studying, or stared into space, book plugs in their ears. They took it all terribly seriously. The room was warm. She could smell her own body. She wondered why she was scheduled so early. Her stomach fluttered. It was easy to be facetious and irreverent to a piece of paper. The inner door opened, and a tall red-headed girl came out. Behind her was a man in a white cotton pullover with New York Library stenciled on it in green. That was Mikulski, the committee secretary. Everybody in the waiting room came to attention. He said,
Carlos Sahedi,
and a boy with pimples left the couch and went in. Mikulski shut the door. The red-headed girl let out her breath in a loud shoosh.
Well, I'm glad that's over.
What did they ask you?
Half the people waiting began to call questions. Paula crossed her arms over her breasts. Someone brought the red-headed girl a paper slip of water. The girl drank.
Don't bother studying. It's not like that. It's, why do you bite your fingernails?
Paula bit her fingernails. She closed her hands into fists.
Who's on the panel?
Sybil Jefferson, Richard Bunker, 3 or 4 others. I didn't recognize them all. Where did this water come from?
The people around the water cooler moved away to let her reach the spigot. Paula sighed. She stared across the room at the split-sphere projection of the Earth on the far wall. After a long while, Carlos Sahedi came out, Mikulski behind him.
Paula Mendoza.
She went after him into the corridor. The cooler air brushed her sweating face and neck. Mikulski said,
Are you thirsty? I can bring you some coffee.
No, that's all right, she said. Thanks.
Her voice sounded scratchy. He nodded to a door on her right. Voices came through it.
Go on in,
Mikulski said. He went down the corridor. Paula stood still a moment, listening to the people inside the room argue. A woman's voice said,
Why hasn't anybody learned it?
Who could use it?
Said a voice she thought she recognized.
They aren't exactly the likely people to have an anarchist revolution, are they?
Paula pushed the door in and entered the room. Ranged behind a shiny table, the 6 members of the panel turned to face her. She shut the door and went straight up toward them, itching with nerves.
I'm Paula Mendoza, she said.
The six faces stared blankly back at her. The fat woman in the middle was Sybil Jefferson, her cheeks powder white. She flipped over a page in the loose-bound book before her.
Your father was Akeem Morgan, the behaviorist, wasn't he?
Yes, Paula said, startled.
I met him once. He was very didactic.
He was strong-minded, Paula said, angry. Her father was dead. He wasn't didactic. The slight, dark man on Jefferson's right leaned forward over the table.
Why do you want to work for the committee?
That was Richard Bunker, and it was his voice she had recognized.
I'm not sure I do, she said. Sorry, I'll rephrase it. Why did you apply?
She made herself stare straight at him. Because the committee has forgotten its purpose. It was formed for the sake of revolution. Now it's just a vestigial government. I wanted a chance to tell you you failed. The six faces did not change. Nobody seemed outraged. Bunker leaned back. He was as dark as Tony, slight and short. His hands on the table were thin-boned like a woman's. He said,
The general idea is that the committee protects the condition of anarchy, and within the anarchy, people have the freedom of their own lives. What do you think we should do? Smuggle revolutionary propaganda to Mars and Venus? Form cadres? Blow up Crosby's planet?
No, I... At the other end of the table, a man called,
Under what circumstances would you advocate the use of force?
Be brief, someone else muttered.
2,500 words or less.
Force is inefficient, Paula said. A trickle of sweat ran down her side. She wished she had accepted Mikalski's offer of coffee. I'll reserve the remaining 2,497 words.
You didn't answer the question, Sybil Jefferson said.
She smiled at Paula. Her eyes were china blue. It's meaningless. If you'd rationalize force in one circumstance, you rationalize it all the time. Bunker said,
I still want to know how you'd promote the revolution.
Disband the committee, she said. Anytime there's trouble now, people just depend on you to negotiate it out. If you disbanded, people would have to find their own solutions. Mikalski came in with a tray. She smelled coffee. He transferred the pot to the table in front of Bunker and a plate of sugar nuts to the table in front of Jefferson, put two stacks of cups between them, and started out. Paula said, Mikalski, could I have some too, please?
There's an extra cup.
The six committee members were clustered around the coffee pot. Jefferson bit into a sugar nut. When she talked, she sprayed white frosting across the table.
The anarchy has to have some means to defend itself. The rest of the system isn't as advanced as you are.
Nobody can take anybody else's freedom away, Paula said. The other people were going back to their chairs. She poured coffee into the remaining cup. Not unless you give it up. The broad breast of Jefferson's red tunic was snowy with frosting.
I suppose you know about that. You were in prison once, weren't you?
On Mars, Paula said. For 6 months.
What for?
For trying to take something out of Barsoom illegally. Barsoom was the capital of Mars.
A camera, Jefferson said. Did you forget about the export duty?
No, I didn't think the Martian government had any right to charge me for taking my own camera with me. She drank her coffee. They were watching her as if she were performing. She supposed she was. Bunker pushed his cup away across the table. He had a reputation for double dealing. Mitchell Wiley, Mikalski had called him once behind his back, the folk name for Machiavelli. Someone else said,
I thought you had connections on Mars, Mendoza.
She put the cup down on the table. They did know everything about her.
I worked for Cam Savinia when she ran for election to the Martian Senate, but when I was arrested, she fired me.
Cam Savinia? Bunker's head snapped up, wide-eyed. Dr. Savinia? You worked in a Martian election?
I wanted to see what it was like.
That's suspect.
It wasn't my planet.
Well, well, well.
What was it like? Asked the woman who had mentioned her connections.
Hocus pocus, Paula said, and the other people laughed. She looked at Bunker.
Why is that a well, well, well?
Dr. Savinia and RB do not get along, Jefferson said. You're 29, Mendoza? You've never had a full-time job before?
Just with Dr. Savinia that time.
But not on the Earth. How do you live?
I substitute with the university orchestra. I do a little pickup work with the recording studios. That's all the money I need.
What do you play?
Flute.
Oh, really?
The old man at the end of the table tilted himself forward over his fisted hands.
Do you like Alfide? Why don't you make a career out of that?
I'm not good enough. Alfide is my favorite composer. And Ivanov. And me.
What do you know about the Stiths? Jefferson said.
She drank the rest of her coffee. Obviously, they had even discovered that. They're mutants. They live in artificial cities in the gas planets, Uranus and Saturn.
We all know that much.
The old woman pulled a sugar nut apart with her hands. The edge of the table indented her fat stomach.
Don't you know anything else?
Well, she said, I speak Stith. They all moved slightly, inclining toward her, their eyes intent. Bunker said smoothly,
So we're told. You learned it in prison?
Yes, there were three Stiths locked up in the men's unit. The warden needed somebody to teach them the common speech. Jefferson ate the sugar nut.
But instead you learned Stith. Why?
I couldn't very well pass up the chance. Stith is the only other language still being spoken. She stopped. That seemed enough, but they all stared at her as if they expected more. She said, The warden was driving me crazy.
You don't really expect us to hire you, do you?
Jefferson said. I'm not sure I want the job.
Well, Bunker said, we are offering you a job. The Interplanetary Council wants us to negotiate a truce between the Middle Planets and the Stith Empire. Unfortunately, none of us speaks any Stith.
Oh, Paula said. Well, get some tapes. It's not hard. Lots of little rules and things. Genders. Jefferson was eating the last of the sugar nuts. Paula saw why she was so fat.
Take the job, Mendoza. We don't have time to scour the system looking for an anarchist who speaks Stith.
All right, she said. Meanwhile, she would find something else.
Tony said, You're selling your soul.
I don't have a soul. And if I did, they're paying me a fortune for it.
$800 a month.
That was more than he made.
You are an inveterate materialist.
He picked up a black pebble. On the grid between them, broken lines of black and white stones faced each other, shaping the space of the game. Tony's hand hovered over the board.
You can always come here and live with me.
He put the black pebble down, watching her face. It's educational.
Working for the committee? Being a cop?
Most people played Go in silence. Tony had developed the tactic of distracting conversation to the point where he could not play without talking. On the grid between them, she could close two positions with a single crucial play. Tony had to keep forcing her to play elsewhere, which he was doing. She sat back, taking a deep breath. Tony put his head forward.
Look at what the committee does. They leech off the anarchy. It's in their best interest that people fail. Are you going to play or not?
She played.
Aha,
he said, and with a click put a stone down on the grid, rescuing his men.
You just don't have the stamina. I'm way ahead of you, you know.
Is wanting to win so much that you pant a sign of materialism?
His apartment was on the ground floor of an old stone building near the edge of the wood. The five rooms were stacked with books and manuscripts. He taught style. They made dinner in his kitchen, arguing about the committee, and went to bed, where he also
sample complete. Ready to continue?